We're pleased this morning to have participating on this panel two distinguished scholars, the Walters, Walter Burns, AEI in Georgetown, and Dellinger, Walter Dellinger from Duke Law School. What we're going to do is I'm first going to take about 5 minutes to remind you of the procedural context in which we are now resolving death penalty issues, setting up some discussion down the way, I suppose. Professor Burns will then follow with his argument, and then we will, Professor Dellinger will follow with his argument, and then we will have some colloquy for the panel and open the discussion to the audience. As you hear the give and take, understand that we probably are not going to have, at least in these opening statements, any kind of a direct confrontation. Understand that one of the commentators in this subject noted that there are 65 arguments for and 87 arguments against the death penalty. So our ability to have a direct collision of viewpoint is at least mathematically against us. But we're going to try. We're going to open the subject, get it on the table, and hopefully we can make some progress. An increasing number of the death sentence prisoners that are now entering the appellate stages of the federal habeas corpus process cast a big social cloud, a cloud that's been there for some time. By September of 1987, 93 persons had been executed since the Supreme Court approved the state capital punishment schemes in the Jurek Trilogy in 1976, and that figure now stands at approximately 101 persons. 44 were executed in the Fifth Circuit, the circuit that I am from, and 26 of those people were from Texas. The data that I have shows that on March the 1st of this year, some 2,021 persons were on death row. Of those, 357 were in the Fifth Circuit and 260 in Texas alone. If you add to that the balance of our old circuit, the 11th Circuit now, you will find a substantial percentage of the persons on death row located in those states. Whether to stay in execution for plenary consideration lies in reality at the intersection of conflicting forces of careful review and prompt enforcement of a state's solemn judgment. The urgency inherent in such a decision is complicated by the fact that relevant constitutional standards continue to evolve. In the past 10 years, the Supreme Court has granted plenary review in at least 67 cases. At least 35 of these cases presented issues with substantial reach beyond the case taken. New constitutional issues, in fact, seem to lie at each turn, with each term. For example, in May, of 8 cases pending before the Supreme Court, at least 6 had broad-ranging issues. In the 1986 term alone, the Supreme Court acted on 80 requests for stays of execution, granting 40 and denying 40. It is self-evident that the common duty of the courts and the bar to develop and to abide procedures that allow these appeals to be decided both fairly and efficiently is being challenged not only by the number of cases and their demands for relatively quick decisions, but also and significantly by the dynamic flux of the law that we are duty-bound to apply. Let me first provide a brief explanation of a reminder for most of you of the long process by which a state prisoner's petition for a stay of execution reaches the federal courts. Of course, after a criminal defendant has been found guilty and sentenced to death, he first pursues his direct appeal through the state judicial system. He then seeks certiorari from the United States Supreme Court, a seldom successful effort, an observation that we will perhaps return to. Perhaps because the system virtually assumes that this first petition for certiorari is far from a petitioner's last. After the direct review provided by the state, the prisoner seeks collateral review in state and federal courts through the writ of habeas corpus. In the words of Justice White, and I quote, "The role of federal habeas proceedings, while important in ensuring that constitutional rights are observed, is secondary and limited. Federal courts are not forums in which to relitigate state trials. Even less is federal habeas a means by which a defendant is entitled to delay an execution indefinitely. Directly stated, federal courts are not available for second trials. Rather, they are, or they perhaps they should be, only the constitutional backstop. You have to keep in mind that the usual principles of res judicata and collateral estoppel simply do not apply in habeas proceedings. At the same time, there are procedures aimed at reducing these long delays and seemingly endless reexamination of issues that have haunted the Great Writ. For a district court to review a petition for habeas corpus, it must issue a certificate of probable cause, attesting that the prisoner has made a, quote, substantial showing of a denial of a federal right. If the district court declines to issue the certificate, it must state its reasons. On appeal from that decision, the circuit court cannot review the merits of the petition unless it determines in its own judgment to issue a certificate of probable cause. On the other hand, if the federal district judge grants a certificate of probable cause, the Court of Appeals must consider the merits of the appeal and grant any stays that are necessary to that review. Now, in deciding whether to issue a certificate of probable cause, the district court properly may consider that it is a death case, but that fact alone does not warrant issuing a certificate of probable cause, and I'm here simply attempting to recite the current rules. A prisoner must make a substantial showing of a denial of a federal right by demonstrating, quote, that the issues are debatable among jurists of reason, that a court could resolve the issues in a different manner, or that the questions are adequate to deserve encouragement to proceed further. We give weighty consideration to a district court's denial of certification, but resolve any doubts about the decision in favor of the prisoner. These standards govern a prisoner's first habeas petition in federal court. Review of a second or successive federal habeas petition is more stringent, at least since the 1982 decision of the Supreme Court in Barefoot versus Estelle. A second or subsequent petition may be dismissed if the judge, and I'm quoting, finds that it fails to allege a new or different ground for relief, or if the failure of the petitioner to assert those grounds in a prior petition constituted an abuse of the writ. These more stringent standards apply even where a successive habeas petition is a prisoner's last chance for review before execution. Whether a petition is the petitioner's first, second, or even third, one is likely to be filed on the eve of a scheduled execution, and that's understandable. The four inquiries for determining whether to grant injunctive or equitable relief also control the grant of a stay of execution, such as the likelihood that the prisoner will prevail on the merits, whether he will sustain irreparable injuries, by definition present in most stay cases, the extent to which the stay would harm other parties, and whether the stay would serve the public interest. So those then are the rough, generally stated, rules of the game that are now out there. That's basically the terrain in which these cases come up. Before I turn to my panelists, one observation. When we talk about the law of habeas, there is a tendency, particularly when the debate turns to the question of whether or not there might be reasonable restrictions placed upon successive petitions, whether we are really faithfully serving the principle that I have stated, that the primary trial will be in the state, and it is ultimately the state policy that will be implemented. Whether we're faithfully serving that, when the discussion turns in those directions, we find that habeas becomes an untouchable. That when one talks of habeas, you find in reply frequently that you are now tampering with a great writ, the writ that's been handed down since Magna Carta. Let me first introduce the panel, point out to you that Brown v. Allen is 35 years old. Until Brown v. Allen, the federal court's role in habeas was to question the presence or the absence of jurisdiction in a state court. When that had been determined, essentially the federal role ended. So that if today one proposes to in some way get this system into an administrable system, you face this particular the argument that in fact it is the great writ we are tampering with. I suggest to you that you keep in mind that it's the great writ as we now see it at best is 35 years of age.
Thank you. not a lawyer. I think I'm probably the only non-lawyer on this program. The only thing I remember about Brown v. Allen, Judge Higginbotham, is I think that's where Justice Jackson said, we are not final because we're infallible. We're infallible because we're final, right?
Good lawyer's memory.
The title of this panel, as it appears in your program, is Can the Death Penalty Be Administered Constitutionally? The title of this panel, as it appeared in the letter inviting me to participate in it, as well as in the Xerox copy of the program that I received a couple of weeks ago before I sat down to prepare these remarks, was is the constitutionality of the death penalty. Now, Professor Dellinger, I gather, will address the subject announced in your program. I will address the subject announced in my program. And if we're lucky, his program and mine will at some point coincide. There, of course, is no argument, nor can there be an argument, about the original intent of the Constitution on this matter. In four discrete clauses, five if one counts the 14th Amendment, the Constitution refers to the death penalty in a manner permitting its imposition. Thus, leaving aside the host of questions related to the manner in which it is imposed, due process or equal protection questions, the dispute over its constitutionality focuses on the Eighth Amendment's prohibition of cruel and unusual punishments. We are told that we must interpret that clause in the light of the evolving standards of decency that mark the progress of a maturing society, a clause that I will focus on in my remarks here. The point is, what was understood not to be cruel in 1788-89 is understood to be cruel today, cruel and therefore unconstitutional. The implication of this is that we today have a better understanding of human dignity and a greater respect for human life. Unlike Jefferson, Madison, Washington, and later on Abraham Lincoln, unlike John Locke, Jean-Jacques Rousseau, Immanuel Kant, the greatest of all moralists, and even John Stuart Mill, all of whom in one way or another supported the death penalty. Unlike them, we know the full meaning of human dignity today. Guided by this improved understanding, the Constitution can be improved. Now, of course, the Constitution is indeed amenable to improvement. We have proved that. One might even draw an analogy between the death penalty and the area of its greatest improvement, slavery. With respect to that, slavery, certainly the Constitution has been improved. Consider this analogy. Slavery is immoral, but as Abraham Lincoln said, the framers were unable to abolish it. All they could do was treat it in a manner that they hoped would put it on a course leading to its ultimate extinction. The death penalty is immoral, but the framers were unable to abolish it. All they could do was forbid cruel and unusual punishments in the hope that in time the country would come to its senses and see the moral necessity of its abolition. The analogy holds, if measured on a moral scale, the death penalty is the equivalent of slavery. And the constitutional conclusion follows if our moral sensibilities have in fact evolved to the point where we now see the truth of that analogy. Question is, have our standards of decency evolved or improved? Because I think that's what the court means when it uses and when it recites this particular formulation. Have our standards of decency improved in the course of time? Have they improved as our society has matured? Have we a better understanding today of the dignity of man? do we today display a greater respect for human life? And has that better understanding produced a better, more humane world? Or finally, is the 20th century better than the 18th? Well, hardly. In fact, precisely because our human understanding has evolved, I think one can make the case that the 20th is the worst of all centuries. This is the century in which we not only kill each other by the millions, but think it right to kill each other. And moreover, cite philosophical texts in support of that judgment. We kill millions of Jews simply because their continued existence as a people seemed to challenge the truth of the Hegelian account of the world historical process, which is to say, of the inexorable march of history toward the universal homogeneous state. Jews whose continued existence challenged the laws of history in such a way that for Karl Marx, the war against capitalism had to begin as a war against Judaism. As he put it in his essay on the Jewish question, I quote, "The social emancipation of the Jew is the emancipation of society from Judaism." Jews whose continued and indeed stubborn existence as a people caused Hitler to wage that war as a final solution to the Jewish question. And not only millions of Jews, but millions of kulaks, whose only crime was their failure to understand the necessity, the historical necessity, of the collectivization of agriculture. And for similar reasons, millions of South Vietnamese, millions of Cambodians, and others. The toll in our time is terrible. Terrible, but according to 20th century morality, wholly justified. What is Jewish life compared with the philosophy of history? In Arnold Toynbee's account, Judaism is a mere fossil of the East. What is a kulak's life compared with the laws of progress? Well, what might you ask has this to do with our country, America? As Lincoln put it at Gettysburg, America is the nation conceived in liberty and dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal. Equal insofar as they are endowed with certain rights, including, conspicuously, the right to life. We are a nation obliged by its founding principles to respect human life. A nation so dedicated, and so long as it remains so dedicated, that it cannot do other than to respect human life. And in the realm of practice, we have done rather well. Very well indeed compared to the rest of the world. Rights withheld from some of us at the beginning are now rather well reserved for all of us. That's the realm of practice. How stand matters in the realm of theory? How many of us who work in the realm of theory, us intellectuals, how many of us whose thought has an effect on the nation's practice, how many of us remain persuaded of the self-evident truth of the principles upon which the nation was founded? At the time of Hitler's assumption of power in Germany, a German scholar could describe the difference between German thought and the thought of Western Europe, and particularly of the United States, describe it as follows. The West still attaches decisive importance to natural right, while in Germany the very terms natural right and humanity have now become almost incomprehensible. While abandoning the idea of natural right, he continued, German thought has created the historical sense and thus was led eventually to unqualified relativism. Can that distinction, drawn some 50 years ago, can that distinction between our thought and German thought still be drawn? Or has something happened to cause us to adopt not only a German vocabulary in our moral discourse, replacing words like good and bad with authentic and inauthentic? Has something happened to cause us to adopt not only German vocabulary, but even the principles of German thought, and in the process, ourselves to become relativists? In the first sentence of his best-selling book, The Closing of the American Mind, Alan Bloom says, "There is one thing a professor can be absolutely certain of. Almost every student entering the university believes, or says he believes, that truth is relative." As a university professor myself, I think that's a true statement. The word encountered in any serious discussion with students is values, a term and idea of German provenance that was intended and is intended to reflect that relativism, the idea that truth is relative. Students today are taught value clarification by their elementary and secondary school teachers. And like their teachers, students take pride in not being judgmental. To challenge these students is to risk being called an absolutist, like Thomas Jefferson, presumably. Even our clergy, including our Catholic bishops, speak of values. Indeed, so prevalent is the usage that few of us are aware of what is implied in that usage. Accordingly, respect for human life becomes a mere value, and as a moral judgment, no more worthy of respect than its opposite. In a world of value judgments, who can rightly denounce Hitler, Stalin, Ho Chi Minh, or Pol Pot? The dignity of man is now understood to consist in his capacity to create his values, whatever they are, with the consequence that everybody is dignified. In the words of Justice Brennan, even the vilest criminal remains a human being possessed of common human dignity. To say the least, our understanding of human dignity has certainly evolved, but I would contend it has conspicuously not improved. Not surprisingly, there has been no improvement in our law and in our actions that are governed by law. Consider the murder statistics. In the past, most murders were committed by people who knew their victims, if not intimately, then at least casually. Spouse, or other relative murders, as the FBI refers to them, or murders committed in barroom brawls and put by the FBI in the category of other arguments. In any case, murders committed in a fit of passion, and in the typical case, committed by persons capable afterwards of feeling remorse. Now, to an ever-increasing extent, murders are committed in cold blood, in the course of mugging or other felonies, stranger murders, as the FBI refers to them. Murders whose victims are unknown to the killers. Murders committed by persons who quite obviously have no respect whatever for the life of another fellow human being. Persons wholly oblivious to moral considerations. murders such as these committed by the Tyson family, whose case came to the Supreme Court. Escaping after a jailbreak in a car that sustained one and then another flat tire, the Tysons flagged down a car which had stopped to, and then proceeded to stop and provide assistance. The Tysons then took possession of the car, as a matter of course, calmly, and then, equally as a matter of course, blasted away with their shotguns, killing the four occupants of that car. The husband, wife, 15-year-old niece, and a 2-year-old son. Calmly, in John Locke's words, not passionately, but sedately, murdered them. These are the sort of murders we read about in the Supreme Court reports, because these are the sort of murders for which the typical American jury is likely to impose the death penalty. In other words, these are the kinds of cases in which the constitutionality of the death penalty becomes an issue. It is an issue in part because of a disagreement concerning law, and more precisely, the function of law. Law is meant to control behavior, of course. We all say that. But beyond that, it is meant to teach. To teach even as it controls. To teach what it means to live in a human community. To remind us of the responsibilities we bear towards each other. Thou shalt not murder is one of the expressions of that law. Thou shalt not murder another, a fellow human being. And as we learn from the first recorded case, a person who violates it must be removed from that community, either by being banished to the land of Nod east of Eden, or executed. Our Constitution no longer permits banishment, but it permits executions, not of every murderer, not of murderers who kill while temporarily insane or in a fit of uncontrollable passion, murderers who, for a moment at least, act as they know human beings ought not to act. But it permits the execution of murderers who kill in cold blood, who gun down an altogether innocent child as readily as they would swat a fly. The Constitution that would forbid their execution would not be an improvement over the original. On the contrary, it would be an amoral constitution. By refusing to treat an inhuman act as an inhuman act, it would adopt the perspective of the cold-blooded murderer. It would teach us that nothing, no act, however heinous, puts one outside the bounds of human fellowship. That is not the lesson taught by the Bible or by the philosophers of natural right, for example, John Locke, or by the Constitution as written. But it is the lesson that would be taught by our law if Justice Brennan and the other opponents of the death penalty have their way and succeed in rewriting the Constitution. Thank you.
It's an honor to appear with Walter Burns, whose gentleness of manner and steelness of mind have made him a scholar for whom I have the highest admiration. He has brought clarity and insight and wisdom to history, to political theory, and to law. I will not try to persuade this audience, as distinguished as it is, conservative or vice versa. that the death penalty is wrong or that it is in the abstract unconstitutional. What I will try to do is to make the case that a court and a court proceeding with caution and restraint would not be precluded from holding that the death penalty as it is now being administered violates the Constitution, and to make the further case that such a ruling would be constitutionally sound and fully consistent with both the text of the Constitution and the intent of its framers. I know that I have a challenge in putting that case to you. Let me begin by staking out some large areas of agreement with Walter Burns. I agree that a provision of the written Constitution can only mean what those who adopted it intended it to mean. Those scholars who suggest that a text can mean something other than what the authors intended are arguing a proposition that seems to me simply contrary to basic common sense. The reason we consult the text of the Constitution is precisely because it embodies an understanding reached at a foundational moment by decision makers in the Constitutional Convention or the Congress and the legislatures of the ratifying states. Giving constitutional text a meaning other than that which was originally intended may be a wonderful exercise in creativity. But doing so deprives the text of its legitimating authority, the authority of its drafters and ratifiers. I agree, moreover, that the penalty of death was not in principle unacceptable to those who proposed and ratified the Cruel and Unusual Punishments Clause of the Eighth Amendment. As Justice Powell put it in Furman against Georgia in dissent, there cannot be the slightest doubt that the framers intended no absolute bar on the government's authority to use the death penalty. And yet, I would argue that the death penalty systems currently enforced in this country might very well be contrary to the Constitution. And you're entitled to ask, how so? First of all, and here I want to talk a bit about how we approach the constitutional text generally. First of all, I am persuaded by reading the records of the Constitutional Convention in Philadelphia in 1787 and the debates over the adoption of the Bill of Rights in the first Congress that there is no evidence that the framers intended to limit the application of the Cruel and Unusual Punishments Clause. And I would make a similar argument about the Equal Protection Clause and the Liberty Due Process Clauses of the 14th Amendment. There's no evidence that the framers intended to limit the Cruel and Unusual Punishment Clause to those punishments deemed cruel and unusual at the time of the adoption of the Bill of Rights. What the framers intended to place in the Constitution, what they did place in the Constitution, was a principle of restraint on the powers of government to punish, a principle to be applied in good faith according to the best judgment of constitutional decision makers. Let me digress with a point, with a example deliberately chosen because it moves us away from the beclouding emotion of the issue of capital punishment. Suppose your great-grandmother left you $1,000 with a note that said, when you leave home and go off to school, use this money, but only to buy nutritious food. She wrote the note in, say, 1949. You're now heading off, and you're about to make your first purchase. Now, you determine, similar to the views that Walter Burns and I have about the Constitution, that you are going to abide by what she intended, by her injunction to you to buy nutritious food. You're not just going to take the $1,000 and cheat. How do you go about the good faith determination of whether a purchase is nutritious food. Well, the way Raoul Berger would approach this, and the way those who were involved in developing Attorney General Mises' articulation of original intent apparently would go about it, would be to think that this is an exercise in detective work. You have to go back to grandmother's, great-grandmother's house and find her old cookbooks and her diaries, and you have to read through them, and you have to make notations. You have to find out that great-grandmother said, once wrote, eat fat back twice a day. It greases up the veins and is good for you. Or she says in her diary, had two pecan pies today. Ooh-wee, you know. Evidence is both of what she thought was nutritious and of her own practices, similar to the framers of the 14th Amendment, since that segregation did not defend against equality and the fact that their own galleries were segregated. That's one approach. Or you could conscientiously go about determining that what she said was to use this for nutritious food and try to decide what that consists of. And that the latter approach is quite as arguably as consistent with her intent as the first approach. She did not say, you're to use this money only to buy that list of foods which I have concluded are nutritious and is in my practice. And I think if you think about that example enough, you will see, I think, that there is a major unanswered step in the notion that you go back and look at precisely what that application would have been on the part of the author. What is troublesome, I think, to all of us is that if you go back and follow great-grandmother's particularistic conceptions, fat back is good for you, at least it confines you, or you think it does. You can find these evidences and anecdotes, whereas nutrition leaves some judgment to be exercised by later decision makers. To come back then to our topic, what the framers intended to deny to the government was the use of those punishments determined to be cruel and unusual. If the death penalty system, as it is administered in late 20th century America, meets that description, then the framers intended that it be prohibited. The question, the real question, it seems to me, was put a generation ago by Herbert Wexler of Columbia, who said that the issue of capital punishment is no longer whether it is fair or just that one who takes another person's life should lose his own. We do not and cannot act upon that proposition, and I will elaborate upon that statement of Wexler's. Wexler says, the problem, brother, is whether a small and highly random sample of people who commit murder ought to be dispatched while most of those convicted of identical crimes are dealt with by imprisonment. That is a generation ago, and that, I think, is still the central question facing the administration of the penalty of death. I have not seen a wholly persuasive argument that the penalty of death is in the abstract unconstitutional. In that sense, I agree with what Walter Burns was suggesting this morning about the unpersuasiveness of the argument that the death penalty is contrary to, quote, evolving standards of decency. In this respect, I acknowledge the force of Justice Scalia's observation that the risk of assessing evolving standards is that it is all too easy to believe that that evolution has culminated in one's own present views. But the penalty of death is not administered in the abstract, as Charles Black has reminded us. If the death penalty in our time is in fact administered in such a capricious, episodic, and discriminatory manner that it cannot seriously be thought to advance any significant public purpose, then it fails the most fundamental test of American constitutionalism. If a state were to adopt a punishment called capital lottery, out of every 1,000 persons convicted of, say, homicide, one would be selected by a computer-generated random number for execution. I think, though we would recognize that such a system would have been unknown to the framers, that we would conclude that it would offend the most basic values they embodied in the Constitution. It would hardly advance any serious purpose of deterrence, and for reasons I will suggest, it would not serve any meaningful moral principle of retribution to select 1 in 1,000, or even 1 in 100 or 200, by a computer-generated random number. I put it to you that the system of death by lottery, inflicted on a randomly chosen 1 in 1,000 or 1 in 100, might very well be more constitutionally defensible than the system we now have, which is arguably considerably worse than random. While it establishes no meaningful basis for choosing between those who will die and those who will go to prison, to a constitutionally impermissible degree, it determines who will die on the basis of capricious and illegitimate factors. There is substantial evidence that one is far more likely to receive the death penalty if one's victim is white, if one is poor, if one is ill-educated, mentally retarded, or able to retain representation only by a marginal or inexperienced counsel. The quality of counsel that can generate a 20,000-page transcript at the penalty phase is by far the best indication of whether a defendant will be given a term of imprisonment rather than the death penalty. Although there were 9 separate opinions in Furman against Georgia in 1972, the case in which the Supreme Court, by a vote of 5-4, held all then existing death penalty statutes unconstitutional, and although those are something of a cacophony, I think the court got it about right. And from the strands of that, one can put together a defensible argument. In essence, what the court held in Furman was that out of a large number of persons eligible in law for the death penalty, a few were selected as if by random, by no stated criteria. And a majority of the court held that to violate the Constitution. I think, moreover, and we had a spate of statutes, 35 states quickly enacted new statutes setting guidelines for the imposition of the death penalty. The court held in Gregg against Georgia in 1976 that those statutes were likely to cure the defects that had been seen in the capital punishment system, prospectively assumed that they would, and has since been on a course, to use Robert Weisberg's phrase in the last couple of terms, of deregulating death. But I think those statutes may have papered over the essential Furman problem, and that it is unlikely to be correctable by statutory tinkering. And I think for that we have to look at the Western experience with the death penalty in modern times to see how the problem may be intractable. If you look at that experience, as Frank Zimring and Gordon Hawkins have done in a recent book, the pattern that emerges is so simple it is stunning. Every Western industrial nation has stopped executing criminals except the United States. The list of actively executing countries is not the kind of list we want to be on. Iran in Iraq, Uganda, South Africa, the Soviet Union and its satellites lead the list. Except for the United States, as they note, the list of actively executing countries is just about the same as the list of politically repressive countries. Now, we have the same pattern of infrequency in the United States. Let me disabuse you of any notion that that infrequency was a result of judicial moratorium. We have about 20,000 homicides a year in this country, and that figure has remained, that terrible and tragic figure, has remained stable over time. In 1935, we had the highest number of executions in a single year in American history, 199. By 1952, the number of annual executions dropped below 100. By 1958, there were fewer than 50 executions in the United States. In 1963, 21. In 1964, 15. In 1965, seven. There was one execution in 66, two in 1967. There have been, since the court reopened the possibility of the infliction of the death penalty in Gregg against Georgia and its companion cases, as Judge Higginbottom noted, we've had about 100 executions. Eight a year on average, in years in which there are 20,000 homicides. The difficulty, I think, is that the death penalty, as Zimring has put it, is a punishment in search of a crime. Walter Burns has made a wonderful and powerful argument that retribution is morally justifiable. And I am not persuaded that retribution is an impermissible goal for a legislature to seek. Walter says that moral indignation, anger, and a desire for retribution affirm our humanity and the humanity of the victims, and that that anger is connected fundamentally with justice. And I don't disagree that a legislature could reach that conclusion. That execution, whatever the debate over deterrence is, that execution is simply the morally appropriate punishment for a person who intentionally kills another. But this is the critical point. No American jurisdiction has, in fact, in the modern era, come close to adopting a system of capital punishment based on the moral judgment that it is morally proper to kill those who intentionally kill. The moral equivalence between murder and execution simply did not survive into the modern era. And Walter Burns offers a powerful defense for the capital punishment of the Book of Exodus and the Law of Alfred at common law. And under the early penal statutes, death was the automatic penalty for felonious homicide. It is no longer. And it is near freakish in its imposition. If the system could select out those few who were most deserving, the Tyson case comes to mind, then we might find its retributive aspect to be a defensible constitutional goal. But it doesn't. Justice White said in joining in the opinion and validating the death penalties in Furman against Georgia that he'd been looking at records for 10 years and he had to make a judgment. The Constitution required him to make a judgment. He couldn't prove it. But after 10 years of looking at records, he could see no meaningful basis for the decision of which few should be chosen to die and which should live. Even after Gregg, the first person executed against his will is John Spinkling in Florida, a drifter who killed another drifter who had beaten him, sodomized him, and stolen his money. That's it. Out of all of these horrendous cases, the court in 78 hears Lockett against Ohio. Sandra Lockett, a 21-year-old black woman, drives the car at a pawn shop holdup. There's no evidence that there was any intention on anybody's part to kill. She stays in the car. One of the robbers pulls a gun. The pawn shop owner grabs for it. The gun goes off. He dies. She's in the car. She's sentenced to death. In a country where we're executing eight people for every 20,000 murders. Her death penalty is overturned in the Supreme Court on the grounds it's not, I think, wholly persuasive to me, one that requires that the one open up the penalty phase to any mitigating circumstances, when that is hardly the flaw in a case that until it got to the Supreme Court had been affirmed up the line by the Ohio Supreme Court. It is just inexplicable. I know our time is short, so let me just conclude by saying that choosing 1 in 1,000 or 1 in 100, depending on whether you talk about the number of sentences or the number of executions, even disparages the victims of all those whose killers don't get the death penalty? How do you explain this young officer to whom President Reagan so movingly referred yesterday? The death penalty isn't available for that offense, and even if he were to die in most states, unless there's a special statute about law enforcement officers, he would not be likely to get the death penalty for that. How do you explain that to the family? What I think a family wants is the harshest punishment known to law, but there is no reason why that should be death. I think that any attempt to select for execution a small subgroup from among those who have committed homicide seems doomed to failure. If it is true, as Stewart and as Stevens and Blackman suggested term before last in McCleskey, they suggested that the Balda study, which studied racial discrimination, contained within it findings that there is a very small number of definable homicides for which prosecutors invariably seek and juries invariably return the death penalty. And if Georgia could narrow its statute to that group, it could survive the constitutional muster, which both Blackman and Stevens thought that it failed. There is no such statute presently on the books anywhere. I am skeptical, to be candid, of the capacity to define that small group. But if it could be defined, then intellectually, I think I would have to admit that the Constitution would not preclude that, but I do doubt it. The public desires, and the Constitution permits, the penalty of death, but the public also expects, and the Constitution requires, that a penalty that severe be administered fairly, without racial and economic bias, and without pervasive caprice and mistake. If the court comes to the conclusion that we cannot both have the death penalty and have it administered fairly, surely the only proper conclusion has to be that we cannot, under those circumstances, administer it at all. Thank you.
Let me start our panel by putting a question back to you, Walter, and then I want to get Professor Burns' observation about this. It seems to me that a very powerful argument can be made that the argument you have erected, that is, that the system operates in such a random way that it is a system that cannot be tolerated, is a little more than a direct abolitionist argument, that it is, in fact, an argument for the abolition of the death penalty, because, after all, it is the system that we have. It seems to me that your argument, if it's to be carried, must carry the burden of persuading that there is something unique in the caprice of the system about the death penalty. Otherwise, you're simply saying that the system cannot administer the death penalty, ergo, the death penalty is unconstitutional. That represents, with all deference, the same mental slight and shift that Tony Amsterdam came up with when he originally filed his now famous amicus brief in Boykin. I put to you one question. Inherent in the choice of decisions for juries is what we call the selection of black box decisions. That is, a decision that cannot be rationally justified, yes or no, because it represents an inherent judgment call. That is our fundamental, that particular process of allowing those decisions to be put to juries is inherent in the very jury system. How can we tolerate, under your argument, the decisions by juries of whether to impose the death penalty at all? Or is that a randomness that we must accept?
That is a good question. And I think the answer is that, first of all, I think the problems of randomness are greater with respect to the death penalty than with respect to other crimes. I think we are prepared to and could impose prison sentences on every person who commits a homicide. But we don't have the gradations to decide which of the murderers ought to be executed. We tried to develop these categories of capital murder based on elusive criteria like premeditation, which could be for an instant, We're using elusive mental states to try to define those categories. I do think, and the court has certainly agreed in the past, that the finality of death and the awesomeness of it require that it be demonstrated that it serves some purpose not that cannot be adequately served by a prison term. And I think its imposition deprives it of both the potentially deterrent effect and of the morally retributive effect. Now, your question is a variant of the notion of, aren't you just arguing that the death penalty has too much mercy in it? That is, would you be, people have put it to me as I discussed this with colleagues in the last week, would you be happier than if we executed a lot more people? No, I wouldn't, but I think that doesn't go to the heart of the constitutional argument. It's basically the principle of Skinner against Oklahoma, the 1942 decision, in which the state of Oklahoma was sterilizing persons who'd twice been convicted of a crime, unless the crime was embezzlement or a couple of other sort of white-collar crimes. Now, I don't think anybody ought to be sterilized after committing two crimes for civil or for penal purposes, so that I'd be happy if we exempted bankers or white persons or college graduates or persons making more than $50,000 a year. Any of those would reduce the number of involuntary sterilizations. But surely we would all agree that a statute that took those steps would be contrary to the Constitution.
Let me carry this just one step further. Let us suppose, Professor Dellinger, that we have 10 persons that are on death row. And these 10 persons, we will concede, have been properly selected for execution by all the rules that are in place. They've had fair trials. They've been through the entire system. And all are now on death row. If 5 of those are executed, what is really the standing of the remaining 5 to complain?
Well, I think your question means to say, what is the standing of the 5 who are executed to argue that the other 5 are allowed to go free?
It's just a familiar question of what's the direction of error. And unless you're willing to deal with the direction of error, it seems to me you can't make the argument of randomness.
I think that the Ernest Vandenhaag, who I believe is here today, has made the following thrust at death penalty abolitions, which is quite persuasive, which is the fact that others are allowed to go free does not detract from the culpability of those who die. It doesn't make them any better or any less deserving of punishment simply because others escape it. Well, my response to that is the exemption of those who are in such large numbers exempted deprives the capital sanction of its legitimating governmental purpose. Many of those in the audience may well believe that execution is the morally appropriate response for homicide. But no legislature has taken the position that the public good requires for its advancement that those who commit capital murder be executed. And since the juries are not, it seems to me, from the studies I've seen, able to sort out on rational, non-discriminatory bases who should live and who should die, the government purpose is so undercut by the number of exemptions. If we executed 1 out of 3 perpetrators of homicide, 1 out of 3, that would require more executions this year than all of the executions in the history of the American nation from colonial times to the present. And we are unwilling to do that. And it seems to me we are therefore capriciously picking out a random handful and doing so. And in so doing, we fail to advance the kind of governmental purpose that would justify it. This punishment. It makes it needlessly cruel, and therefore arguably in violation of the clause.
Well, let's let the audience get into this. I'm sure there's someone there who would like to put a question to one of our colleagues.
Really?
Nelson? That mic is just not tall enough for you.
I'd like to follow up on Judge Higginbotham's question, Professor Dellinger. And I would put it very briefly. On your view of the Constitution, would mandatory death penalty statutes for certain classes of crimes pass constitutional muster?
The question is, under my view of the Constitution, would a mandatory death penalty statute for a defined category of crimes be constitutional? If it were possible to define a category of crimes for which prosecutors invariably seek the death penalty and juries invariably impose it, I think that would not be unconstitutional. I do not think that describes any penalty system that we have. The mandatory death penalty statutes that were enacted and struck down by the court were not, in a sense, mandatory at all. The flaw was that you had unbridled discretion to decide not to return a verdict of capital murder, and juries were, in fact, exercising that, and it made the arbitrariness even more unguided and unreviewable by appellate courts. I could elaborate on that, but they just didn't work. So I'm quite confident that the mandatory statutes were unconstitutional because they literally papered over the discretion that was being exercised.
Well, of course, that 10 states responded to Furman by enacting mandatory death penalties, and the court struck those down.
Yeah, and the perfect example was Woodson versus North Carolina itself. Woodson was one of three perpetrators of a robbery. He was the one that stayed in the car. Two that went inside where the shooting and killing occurred. One of them was given the death penalty. One of the others two inside was allowed to plead guilty to accessory after the fact, while Woodson, who was in the car,
to homicide, that you really have to do something exotic to get the death penalty. But the second part we have.
Well, let me just interject to say you would think we're reserving it for particularly heinous crimes, but it is not at all clear that that's what is happening under the statute. This is an empirical question. But you're eligible for the death penalty in most states now if the homicide is committed in the course of any serious felony, so that you are eligible for it if it's a panicky shooting in a
then you're going to the felony in a stick up, which presupposes that if you had the will, if you formed the intent to commit a crime, you accepted the risk that a homicide would result, and therefore you had premeditation at that point. So I was going to say, in Florida, we have people like Ted Bundy languishing on death row. He has been there now almost 10 years since he was convicted. He has outlived the judge that has sentenced him, and we've got.
Ted Bundy is a perfect example in the sense that the prosecutor in the Bundy case offered to plead that case despite of overwhelming evidence against Bundy, offered to plead that horrendous case for life imprisonment.
I was going to say, since
Bundy foolishly turned it down, but...
Bundy was a first-year law student, as we know, who attempted to play a fast one with the judge, and the judge...
Was he going to plead all of his killings?
They were going to eliminate the possibility of the death penalty, which I think is just, these are all episodic examples, the judge, but they go to the fact that even Bundy could have walked and not been among the handful who were.
The second question I was going to ask was, opponents of the death penalty throw innumerable roadblocks into the carrying out of justice. In Bundy's case, we've got a law firm here in D.C. that has expended $250,000 in pro bono time to obstruct Bundy's date with justice. And then the opponents of the death penalty said, see, the system is clogged up. And they're the ones who are clogging it.
That's why I thought it.
Okay, let me. Yeah. Jane Myers warned us to bring this to a close. And I believe that you had a question. Let me get your question.
Professor Dellinger, it seems to me that you're arguing that because most murderers are not being executed, or because most murderers may deserve to be executed and they are not being executed, then something's wrong with the system.
That's right.
That's right. So no one should be killed, even though the people who deserve to be killed aren't being killed? It's a very strange argument.
It may be strange.
Is that a question?
How strange. The question is, if I remember, how strange is that argument, was essentially the question.
Well, let's have one more question.
Let me treat it seriously by saying that if we do not believe, if state legislatures do not enact statutes, and if the system cannot administer the death penalty in a way that has any meaningful moral basis of selecting who should live and who should die, then it is not serving the purposes of appropriate retribution if it's just a lottery. And no one should die in a lottery which is needlessly cruel in the sense that it does not advance any goals of deterrence or serious moral retribution.
One more question and we'll bring it to a close.
Justice Brennan lays great stress on the irreversibility of the death penalty. There's no arguing that it's irreversible. There is also no question that an executed killer will never kill again. However, is there not a simple answer to that problem? If we're going to put someone to death, should not the degree of proof be the highest possible? I propose then, instead of guilt beyond a reasonable doubt, the death penalty should be imposed only if the jury unanimously certifies there is no doubt whatsoever that this person committed that murder. What do you think of that?
I'll pass. Go ahead.
Let me bring this to a close. Professor Burns described in a publication, Crime and Delinquency, the response to his book, which he published in 1979, entitled For Capital Punishment, Crime and the Morality of the Death Penalty. He said that he had anticipated being denounced in the liberal press, and he says that he says he was. Interestingly, after a debate on live television here in Washington, Professor Burns had to change his home telephone number. Well, Professor Dellinger, we are going to assure you safe passage out.